The road had stolen the last of her shoes. Ilara Vaughan did not look down at them, at the cracked leather and the sole that flapped with every weary step. To look was to acknowledge the finality of it, the last shred of her old life surrendering to the grit and mud of this new one. Hope felt like a phantom limb, an ache for something that was no longer there. 3 years since the world had fallen out from under her, leaving her with nothing but a name nobody dared to speak, and a desperate, gnawing hunger. Blackwood Manor rose from the mist like a granite cliff. It was not a welcoming place. It was a declaration of power, of permanence, of everything she had lost. The wrought iron gates were taller than two men, crowned with sharp, unforgiving spikes. Ilara's hand trembled as she reached for the bell pull, her knuckles white against the cold metal. The sound echoed in the unnerving silence, a tiny, impertinent noise against the vastness of the estate. Two footmen in immaculate livery emerged from a gatehouse, their expressions identical masks of bored disdain. They took in her travel-stained dress, the wildness of her hair pinned up in a desperate knot, and finally their eyes fell to her feet. A smirk bloomed on one man's face. The other chuckled, a low, cruel sound. "We're not taking on kitchen scamps today," the first one said, his voice dripping with condescension. "Be off with you." Elara's chin lifted. The gesture was instinct, a ghost of the lady she had once been. "I am not here for the kitchens. I am here to see the Duke." This pronouncement was met with open laughter. It was not the sound of mirth, but of mockery. It scraped against her raw nerves, threatening to undo the fragile composure she had spent miles building. "The Duke?" The second footman wheezed, wiping a tear of amusement from his eye. "And I suppose the King is expecting you for tea? Go on, girl. Don't waste our time." "I will not leave until I have spoken with him," she insisted, her voice quieter than she intended, but firm. It was the only thing she had left. This one, desperate, impossible plan. "She has spirit. I'll give her that," the first one noted to his companion, as if she were a stray dog showing its teeth. "Look here, miss. His Grace, the Duke of Blackwood, does not receive people like you. He doesn't receive much of anyone, for that matter. Now, unless you want us to help you on your way, I suggest you turn around and walk back the way you came." Ilara stood her ground. Her heart hammered against her ribs, a frantic bird trapped in a cage of bone. She had nothing to go back to. The road behind her was an abyss of starvation and despair. This gate, this cold, unyielding fortress, was her last chance. She opened her mouth to speak again, to plead or demand, she wasn't sure which, when a new voice cut through the air. "What is the meaning of this?" The voice was deep, resonant, and carried an authority that turned the footmen to stone. They snapped to attention, their faces paling. A tall figure had emerged from the winding path that led from the main house, his long coat unbuttoned against the chill. He moved with a quiet purpose that seemed to consume the space around him. As he drew closer, Ilara could see he was a man in his prime, with dark hair that the wind had slightly disordered, and a face that seemed carved from intellectual severity. His eyes, a startling shade of deep moss green, were fixed on his guards, but it was his hands that caught her attention. The fingers of his right hand were stained with ink, a dark smudge against his pale skin. "Your Grace," the first footman stammered, bowing low. This person was causing a disturbance. We were just sending her away." The Duke's gaze shifted from his men to Ilara. It was a slow, methodical appraisal, missing nothing. He saw the worn dress, the thinness of her frame, the desperate hope warring with humiliation in her eyes. And then, his gaze, like the footman's, fell to her shoe. The laughter was gone now, replaced by a thick, anxious silence. The air grew taut. For a moment, he said nothing. His expression was unreadable, a mask of aristocratic control. Elara's breath caught in her throat. She had failed. He would send her away and the last ember of her plan would be extinguished. But then, his eyes lifted back to her face, and something shifted in their depths. A flicker of disbelief, of dawning recognition that made no sense. He took a step closer, his focus so intense it felt like a physical touch. He seemed to be looking not at her, but through her, at a memory. "Vaughn," he said, the name a soft exhalation of breath. Not a question, but a statement of impossible fact. "Lady Elara?" The world tilted on its axis. The footmen stared, their jaws slack with astonishment. Elara could only nod, a tiny, jerky movement. How could he possibly know her name? How could this man, this powerful, reclusive duke, recognize the ghost of a girl whose family had been erased from society? The Duke of Blackwood turned a look of glacial fury upon his footmen. "You will open these gates. You will go to your quarters. You will not emerge until I send for you. Is that understood?" "Yes, Your Grace," they mumbled in unison, scrambling to obey. The great gates swung inward with a protesting groan. He turned back to Elara, the severity in his face softening into something she could not name. It was not pity. It was something deeper, more complex. "Forgive them," he said. His voice now a low murmur meant only for her. "I have been looking for you for 3 years." He offered her his arm. Elara stared at the fine wool of his coat sleeve, then at her own grimy hand. She could not possibly touch him. But he waited, his arm held steady, his green eyes patient. Hesitantly, she placed her fingers on his arm, a feather-like touch, and allowed the Duke of Blackwood to lead her through the gates of his home. Away from the mocking world, and into a mystery deeper than any she could have imagined. The grand entrance hall was a cavern of marble and silence. Her ruined shoes made no sound on the polished floor, making her feel even more like an apparition. The Duke led her past stern-faced portraits of his ancestors, their painted eyes seeming to follow her with silent judgment. He did not take her to a receiving room or a parlor. Instead, he led her to a small, private study, dominated by a massive desk and floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. A fire crackled in the hearth, casting a warm, dancing light over the room. "Please," he said, gesturing to a worn leather armchair by the fire. He did not sit himself, but stood by the mantelpiece, watching her. The silence stretched between them like a thread of spun glass, beautiful and ready to shatter. A housekeeper, a formidable woman with grey hair pulled into a severe bun, appeared at the door. Her eyes widened fractionally at the sight of Elara, but her expression was quickly schooled into neutrality. "Mrs. Gable," the Duke said, his tone leaving no room for question. "This is Lady Elara Vaughn. She is my guest. She will be staying with us. Please have the rose suite prepared for her, and bring tea, and food, something substantial." "Very good, Your Grace," the woman, Mrs. Gable, replied, her gaze lingering on Elara for a moment before she departed with a crisp nod. Elara sank into the chair, the soft leather a luxury her body had forgotten. The warmth from the fire began to seep into her chilled bones, but the cold knot of confusion in her stomach remained. "Your Grace," she began, her voice hoarse, "I do not understand." "I imagine you do not," he said. He moved from the mantelpiece to the desk, his ink-stained fingers resting lightly on a stack of papers. "Your father, Lord Julian Vaughn. We were correspondents." This was another shock. Her father, a quiet scholar obsessed with botany, corresponding with a duke. "About what?" she whispered. "Orchids," he said simply. "Specifically, the Dendrophyllax lindeni, the ghost orchid." He believed he had discovered a way to cultivate it from seed, a feat no one had managed before. "He sent me his research. He also sent me examples of his illustrator's work." He paused, his green eyes locking with hers. "He sent me your drawings, Lady Alara." The room seemed to shrink. Her art. The one piece of herself she had treasured, the quiet hours spent with pen and watercolor, capturing the delicate veins of a leaf or the intricate curl of a petal. It was the only part of her father's legacy she had managed to carry with her, a single, battered sketchbook saved from the wreckage. "I was preparing to fund his expedition," the Duke continued, his voice low and laced with a strange old regret. "We were on the cusp of a significant discovery. And then, I received word of his death, of the collapse of the estate. By the time my agents arrived, you were gone, vanished." He looked at her, and for the first time, she saw past the ducal authority to the man beneath. She saw a flicker of frustration, of a puzzle left unsolved for 3 long years. "I have been searching for any trace of you or your father's final notes ever since." "Mrs." Gable returned with a tray, her movements efficient and silent. She set down a silver teapot, delicate china, and a plate piled high with sandwiches and small cakes. The aroma of fresh bread and warm tea made Ilara's head spin with a hunger so profound it was painful. She waited until the housekeeper had gone, her hands trembling in her lap. "The notes are gone," she said, the words tasting of ash. Everything was seized. Sold. The books. The research. Everything. "I see," he said, his expression closing off again. He looked disappointed, and a fresh wave of failure washed over her. She had come here with a half-formed plea for employment, perhaps as a companion or a governess, using the faint hope that a duke interested in botany might value her skills. She had not expected this. She had not expected to be a missing piece of his past. "Please," he said, his voice softening as he gestured to the tray. "You must eat." She did, her movements stiff and awkward at first, then driven by a desperate need. She ate with the focused intensity of the truly starved, trying and failing to maintain the decorum that had been drilled into her since birth. The Duke, to his credit, turned away and pretended to examine a book from his shelf, granting her a small measure of privacy. When she was finished, a sense of profound exhaustion settled over her. The warmth, the food, the sudden, shocking safety of her surroundings were a potent combination. "You will stay here, Lady Alara," the Duke said, turning back to her. It was not a request. It was a statement of fact. "You are safe here. We will discuss the future later. For now, you must rest." "Mrs." Gable reappeared to guide her to the Rose Suite. It was a set of rooms larger than the entire cottage she had last shared with 2 other families. A fire was already blazing in the bedroom hearth, and a hot bath had been drawn in the adjoining chamber. Laid out on the bed was a simple but elegant nightgown of soft lawn. As she soaked in the steaming water, the grime and sorrow of the road melting away, Alara felt a sense of profound dislocation. She had knocked on a door she had no right to knock on. And the man who answered had been looking for her for 3 years. She was no longer a beggar. She was a guest. A project. A ghost he had finally captured. She did not know which was worse. The first few days at Blackwood Manor passed in a surreal haze. Alara slept for most of them, her body and spirit succumbing to a bone-deep exhaustion she hadn't allowed herself to feel during her years of struggle. She ate the meals that were brought to her on a tray, the food rich and plentiful, and she slowly began to feel human again. The Duke left her to her own devices, a courtesy for which she was profoundly grateful. Her new wardrobe appeared as if by magic, simple day dresses of good wool and cotton in muted shades of blue and gray. Her torn shoes were gone, replaced by sturdy, soft leather boots. The transformation was so complete that the woman who looked back at her from the mirror was a stranger, paler, thinner, and with a haunted look in her eyes that the old Ilara had never possessed, but a lady nonetheless. On the 4th day, she felt strong enough to explore. The house was a labyrinth of quiet corridors and dust-sheeted rooms. The silence was absolute, broken only by the ticking of a grandfather clock or the distant muffled sounds of a servant at work. It was a lonely place, she realized, a grand empty shell waiting for a life that never seemed to happen. She found her way to the library. It was even more magnificent than the Duke's study, a two-story cathedral of books, with a rolling ladder to reach the upper shelves. Sunlight streamed through tall, arched windows, illuminating the dust motes dancing in the air. This was a room that felt lived in. Books were stacked on tables, one left open as if its reader had just stepped away. And on a large table in the center of the room there were botanical texts, dozens of them, open to pages filled with exquisite illustrations of orchids. She was tracing the lines of a cattleya with her fingertip when he spoke from the doorway, making her jump. I thought I might find you here. The Duke, Alistair, as he had insisted she call him in private, walked into the room. He was dressed less formally today, without a coat, his shirt sleeves rolled up slightly, revealing strong forearms. The ink stains were still on his fingers. It is a magnificent collection, Your Grace, she said, her voice still shy. Alistair, he corrected gently. And it is my one true passion. A quiet obsession, my father called it. A faint, sad smile touched his lips for a moment. He preferred horses. He walked to the table and stood beside her, his presence a warm, solid thing in the quiet room. He smelled of old paper, ink, and a faint, clean scent of winter air. My interest is academic, he said. But yours? Your father wrote that you had the gift. That you could see the life in a plant, not just its structure. Elara's cheeks warmed with a flush of pleasure. My father was a kind critic. He was a scientist, Alistair countered. They are not known for their kindness, but for their precision. He picked up a book, its pages filled with the famous engravings of Georg Dionysius Eret. This is masterful. It is accurate. But it is cold. He then looked at her. Your drawing of the ghost orchid, the one your father sent me, it had a soul. He had kept it. The thought sent a strange flutter through her chest. I have nothing left of my work, she said, the admission costing her. Only one sketchbook survived. And it is mostly filled with rough studies. He seemed to consider this for a moment. Then he walked to a cabinet in the corner of the library and unlocked it. He returned with a fresh, leather-bound sketchbook, a box of fine charcoal pencils, and a set of watercolors. He placed them on the table before her. Then you will begin again, he said. His words settled over her like a heavy velvet cloak, strangely warm and suffocating all at once. There is a conservatory at the west end of the manor. It is my private domain. The collection of orchids is extensive. You may use it as you wish. Consider it your studio. It was not a request. It was a commission. A purpose. He was giving her back the one thing she thought she had lost forever. But it was also a chain, binding her to him, to this house, with a debt of gratitude that felt impossible to repay. Thank you, Your Grace, she whispered. Alistair, he said again, and this time there was a hint of warmth in his green eyes. My name is Alistair. The conservatory became her sanctuary. It was a world of glass and steel, filled with humid air and the sweet, earthy scent of orchids. Alistair's collection was beyond anything she had ever seen. There were hundreds of plants, from the flamboyant to the minuscule, their blossoms a riot of color and shape. He had employed the best gardeners, created the perfect environment, yet it was clear this was his personal passion. She began to draw. At first her hands were clumsy, her eye uncertain. The 3 years of hardship had created a stiffness in her fingers and a tremor she could not control. But slowly, day by day, as she lost herself in the intricate patterns of a phalaenopsis or the waxy perfection of a cymbidium, the skill returned. The line became sure again. The color, true. Alistair would often find her there. He never interrupted, but would stand at a distance, observing her work or tending to his plants. They rarely spoke, but a strange, quiet companionship grew between them in that glass house. She learned the rhythms of his days, the quiet intensity of his focus. He was a man who lived entirely in his head. In a world of research and scholarly pursuit, one afternoon he brought her a plant on a small tray. It was not in bloom. It was a strange, leafless tangle of greenish roots clinging to a piece of cork bark. "This is it," he said, his voice hushed with a kind of reverence. "Dendrophyllax lindeni, the ghost orchid. I have 3 specimens. None have ever bloomed in my care. They are notoriously temperamental. They require a precise balance of humidity, light, and air that is nearly impossible to replicate." He set it on the workbench in front of her. "Your father believed the key was a specific mycorrhizal fungus found only in the cypress swamps where they grow. His notes were preliminary, but he was convinced he was close to isolating it." Elara looked at the strange, spectral plant. It looked more dead than alive, a web of pale roots clinging to life. It was the plant that connected them, the reason she was here. It felt like a test. As the weeks turned into a month, Elara's position in the household solidified into a strange sort of limbo. She was not a servant, but she was not truly family. "Mrs." Gable treated her with a cool, professional respect, but Elara could feel the unspoken questions from the rest of the staff. Who was this woman the Duke had installed in the Rose Suite? Why did he spend hours with her in the conservatory? Her own fears were her greatest antagonist. Every time she caught her reflection in a polished table or a pane of glass, she expected to see the vagrant in torn shoes. She felt like an imposter, living a borrowed life that could be snatched away at any moment. The Duke's kindness was a constant, gentle pressure. She owed him everything: the food she ate, the clothes she wore, the pencils she held in her hand. The weight of that debt was suffocating. One evening, a letter arrived for her. It was the first correspondence she had received in 3 years. It was from a distant aunt, her mother's cousin, who had heard rumors of Elara's new situation. The letter was a masterpiece of passive aggression, filled with warnings about propriety, the dangers of being a ward to a reclusive and unmarried duke, and the damage to what little was left of the family name. Elara read it in her room, the words twisting in her gut. "You must be careful not to be seen as an opportunist, my dear. A man in his position has certain needs. You must not allow yourself to be compromised." She felt a hot flush of shame, followed by a cold spike of anger. The letter gave voice to all her deepest insecurities. Was that what they all thought? That she was the Duke's charity case, or worse, his mistress? She clutched the letter, her knuckles white. The old Elara would have hidden it away, would have let the shame fester. But the woman who had spent a month finding herself again in a glass house full of flowers was different. She had found a sliver of her own strength in the steady lines of her drawings. She found Alistair in his study, poring over a map of Florida. He looked up as she entered, his expression questioning. Without a word, she handed him the letter. She watched his face as he read it. His jaw tightened, and a muscle ticked along his cheek. The calm, scholarly mask was gone, replaced by a cold, ducal fury that was formidable to behold. When he finished, he did not look at her, but at the letter, which he held in his hand as if it were something foul. "She will receive a reply," he said, his voice dangerously quiet. "From my solicitor. It will be made very clear that you are an honored guest in my home, and that any further slander will be met with legal consequences." "That isn't why I showed it to you," Elara said, surprised by her own boldness. "I don't care what she thinks. I showed it to you because I need to know what my position here is. Am I your guest? Your ward? Your botanical illustrator?" He finally looked at her, and his eyes were filled with a deep, aching regret. You are the daughter of a man I respected more than any other in his field. You are a brilliant artist in your own right. And you are the woman I have spent 3 years trying to find. That is your position here, Ilara. Anything else is noise. It was more than he had ever revealed. It was a crack in the formidable armor he wore, a glimpse of the man who had been searching not just for notes but for her. I will not be a burden, she said, her voice trembling slightly. I will earn my keep. You already have, he said, his voice softening. He gestured to a portfolio on his desk. She recognized it as the one where he kept her new drawings. This is more valuable to me than you can possibly know. She had protected herself. She had faced the external judgment, and in doing so, forced a clarification of the unspoken terms between them. She left the study that night feeling lighter than she had in years. She was not a charity case. She was a collaborator. And that, she realized, was a foundation she could build on. The moment of truth came on a gray afternoon, weeks later. Ilara was in the conservatory, working on a detailed study of the ghost orchid. She had drawn it a dozen times, trying to capture its ethereal quality, the strange intelligence in its tangled roots. It remained a mystery, a plant that refused to yield its secrets. Alistair entered, his face grim. He held a letter in his hand. From my agent in London, he said, his voice flat. He located a crate of your father's books at a minor auction house. They were sold 3 years ago to a private collector who has since died. The collection is being broken up. He paused. There is no mention of any notebooks or loose papers. The last, faint hope that her father's final research might be recovered, died. Ilara felt it go with a quiet sigh. Then it is lost, she said. It would seem so, he agreed, the disappointment heavy in his voice. He stared at the dormant orchid as if willing it to speak. All that work, all that genius, gone. Ilara looked from his face to the plant, and then to her own sketchbook. She had brought her old, battered one with her to the conservatory that day, hoping to find some inspiration in her early, less practiced sketches. It was the only thing, besides the clothes on her back, that had survived her old life. The cover was scarred, the pages warped from damp. An idea, faint and uncertain, began to form in her mind. Perhaps not all of it, she said slowly, her heart beginning to beat faster. She opened the old sketchbook. Her early drawings were there, clumsy and youthful, but filled with a passion she recognized. She flipped through pages of local wildflowers, studies of leaves, dissections of seeds. And then, she came to the back. Her father had often used her old sketchbooks for his own quick notes, tucking calculations and observations among her drawings. Tucked into a small pocket on the inside back cover was something she had forgotten entirely. A small, pressed flower, its form delicate and pale even in its desiccated state. And tucked behind it, a folded piece of paper, covered in her father's tiny, precise script. Her breath hitched. Alistair moved closer, his eyes fixed on the paper. It was not a full treatise. It was a series of observations, a recipe almost, written in the shorthand he used when an idea was coming to him in a rush. It detailed the composition of the soil, the specific strain of fungus, the exact temperature and humidity required, not just for the orchid to survive, but to bloom. It was the key, the missing piece of the puzzle. He must have put it here for safekeeping, she whispered, her voice thick with emotion. He always said my sketchbook was the safest place in the house, because no one would ever think to look in it. Alistair took the paper from her, his hand shaking almost imperceptibly. He read it, his green eyes scanning the lines with a fierce, burning intensity. A slow smile spread across his face, transforming his severe features into something boyish and radiant. It was the first time she had ever seen him truly smile. Ilara, he breathed, looking from the paper to her, and his eyes were filled with an emotion so raw, so full of awe and gratitude that it stole her breath. You found it. You saved it. In that moment, the entire dynamic between them shifted. He was no longer the powerful Duke and she the rescued waif. They were partners, standing on the precipice of a discovery their fathers had begun. He was vulnerable, his carefully constructed walls of control and discipline completely gone, replaced by the pure, unadulterated joy of a scholar who has just been handed the answer to his life's greatest question. He saw her not as a relic of the past, but as the agent of their future. The power in the room now belonged to her. She knew she had a choice. She could accept his gratitude, remain his protected, indebted illustrator, and watch from the sidelines as he brought her father's work to fruition. She could be the footnote in his story, or she could claim her own place in it. That evening, she did not wait for him to summon her. She sought him out. She found him in his study. The precious piece of paper laid out on his desk under a glass weight, as if it were a holy relic. He was surrounded by books and charts, already beginning the work of replicating her father's instructions. He looked up as she entered, his smile returning. "I have already sent for the necessary components," he said, his voice alive with an energy she had never heard before. "We can begin within the week." Elara walked to the desk and stood before him. She placed her old sketchbook on the polished wood beside her father's notes. Her hands were steady. Her voice when she spoke was clear and strong. "This is not a debt you owe my father, Alistair," she said, meeting his gaze directly. "This is a legacy, one that belongs to both of us." He looked at her, his expression quizzical, waiting. "I will not be your assistant," she continued, her resolve hardening with every word. "I am not a project to be saved, or a ghost to be honored. I am a botanist. My father taught me everything he knew. Those notes are meaningless without a deep understanding of the principles behind them. An understanding that I have." She took a breath, laying her entire future on this single, terrifying declaration. "I am offering you a partnership. We will do this work together. As equals. Or I will take my father's legacy, and I will find another way." The silence in the room was absolute. Alistair stared at her, his face unreadable. She had challenged him, refused the comfortable role he had created for her, and demanded more. She had risked everything, the safety, the comfort, the sanctuary of Blackwood. For a terrifying moment she thought she had miscalculated, that his pride would be wounded, his charity thrown back in his face. Then, slowly, he stood up. He walked around the desk until he was standing directly in front of her. He was so close she could see the flecks of gold in his green eyes. He did not look angry. He looked, awake, as if he were seeing her for the first time. Not Lady Elara Vaughan, the lost daughter. Not the gifted illustrator. But Elara. He reached out, not to touch her, but to the sketchbook. His ink-stained fingers gently traced the faded name on the cover. "A partnership," he repeated softly. He looked back at her, and his voice was filled with a profound, quiet respect. "Yes," he said, "that is exactly what this should be." He held out his hand. "To our partnership, Elara," she placed her hand in his. His grip was firm and warm. It was not a gesture of rescue but of agreement. A pact made between two equals, sealed in a silent study, over the ghost of an orchid, and the promise of a shared future. In that moment, Elara Vaughan was no longer defined by the torn shoes she had arrived in, but by the steady hand she now held. 2 years later, the conservatory at Blackwood Manor was the most famous in all of England. It was no longer a silent, private domain. Scholars and botanists made pilgrimages to see what the Duke and Duchess of Blackwood had accomplished. In the center of the glass house, in a perfectly calibrated environment, a small, spectral plant was in full, breathtaking bloom. The ghost orchid, Dendrophyllax lindini, had unfurled its delicate white petals, releasing a faint, apple-like scent into the warm, humid air. It was the first of its kind ever to be cultivated and brought to flower in captivity. Elara, now the Duchess of Blackwood, stood before it, a sketchbook in her hand. She was no longer the pale, haunted woman who had arrived at the gates. Her face had a healthy color, and her eyes, once filled with desperation, now shone with confidence and a quiet, abiding joy. Her dress was simple but elegant, and on her finger, beside her wedding band, was a ring engraved with the image of a single perfect orchid. Alistair came to stand beside her, placing a warm hand on the small of her back. The years had softened the severity of his features. The lonely, reclusive Duke was gone, replaced by a man who smiled easily and often, especially when his wife was near. "Our firstborn," he murmured, his eyes on the flower. "She is as beautiful as her mother." Elara smiled, leaning her head against his shoulder. "She is a testament to my father. And to you, you never gave up on him." "I never gave up on you," he corrected gently. He looked down at the sketchbook in her hands. It was filled with new illustrations, more masterful and confident than any she had done before. A book of her work, published under her own name, The Duchess of Blackwood, was to be released in the spring. The manor itself was transformed. The dust sheets were gone, the silent rooms now filled with light and conversation. They hosted gatherings of artists, scientists, and thinkers, turning the once somber house into a vibrant center of intellectual life. The portraits of Alistair's stern ancestors now looked down upon a world they would not have recognized. A world where a duke's wife was his intellectual partner, her name as respected as his. Later that evening, Elara stood alone on the terrace, looking out over the sprawling gardens. She thought, as she sometimes did, of the long road that had brought her here. She remembered the hunger, the cold, the mocking laughter of the footman. She remembered the feeling of the worn-out leather of her shoes, a constant reminder of her fall from grace. Those shoes had brought her to this door, and the man who answered had changed her life. But she knew now that he had not saved her. He had simply opened a door she had been strong enough to knock on. He had given her a space to save herself. True freedom, she had learned, was not the absence of hardship, but the presence of choice. And true worth was not something granted by society or by a title, but something you claimed for yourself, with ink-stained fingers and an unbreakable will. The past was a part of her story, but it was no longer the whole of it. Her future was here, in this garden, beside the man she loved, a future she had drawn, and built, and brought into bloom all on her own.